I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Andrea Quijada. She is the director of the Media Literacy Project here in New Mexico. We're so happy to have you on the air today.
Thanks, Maria Charlotte. I'm happy to be here.
So we're going to find out what media literacy is. How did this whole project start?
Media Literacy Project began in 1993 as the brainchild of Dee Dee Downs, who at that time was living here in Santa Fe. She's the daughter of Hugh Downs and is also a journalist. Some of you may remember Hugh Downs. He was a journalist on 2020, the evening news program, for a few decades. And Dee Dee was really concerned with the decline of journalism and wanting really to find a way to engage young people to think critically about media, and particularly about information and about news. And she started organizing. She brought together different sort of big thinkers from across the country and had some institutes here. And one of the people that attended was a man named Bob McCannon, who at that time was teaching at Albuquerque Academy. And he was teaching a class on propaganda, and he also taught history. And he was really interested in wanting to see this continue. So when Dee Dee needed a place and was looking around for how do I move this from an idea into an actual organization, Albuquerque Academy and the board at that time said that they were willing to take this on. So we are housed at Albuquerque Academy. They function as our fiscal sponsor, and we receive in-kind support from them. And for many years, Media Literacy Project also taught a media literacy course there on campus at Albuquerque Academy for about 10 years, I believe.
And so media literacy, what do you mean by that? What does that term mean?
Many people have questions around what is that exactly? Media literacy is the ability to access, analyze, and create media. So through our very various programs and campaigns, we really work to engage people to think critically about that through all of our work around our monthly deconstructions. I encourage people to see our website at medialiteracyproject.org. We take a media clip every month and we ask some what we call deconstruction questions. We ask things like, who made this piece of media? Who paid for it? Those might be two different. So a company might hire an advertising agency to make their commercial, if it's a commercial that we're looking at. We ask, what's an untold story? What's happening within, you know, what do we see happening within what we're looking at? And then what's a story that maybe they're not telling us? So this product looks really fun, but we're not learning that it's actually out of our price range, or we're not learning how it's actually made and who's involved in that process, or what other story might be left untold or uncovered.
What ingredients are in it that aren't good for you.
Yes, right. We might be looking at, one example could be an ad for a fruity drink, and people think, oh, well, there's fruit on the cover and there's strawberries. When I'm looking at it, it must be fruit juice. And yet what we don't really know until we actually have the product physically in front of us and we turn it over to look at the ingredients, we learn that it's actually 5% juice. And
95% high fructose corn syrup and
at times, exactly. Yeah, color dyes and fructose syrup are much more sugar than we thought. And so just getting people to think critically in that way. We also deconstructed sitcoms, or a clip of a sitcom or of a movie or of a news program. So we're really wanting people to think critically about all of these types of media, particularly now when we live in a time where we can be inundated with media even on our smartphones. If someone has a smartphone, they can watch a video and they can be tweeting and on their Facebook page and sending and receiving messages all the time, which is great. We believe in media as a tool for communication, but we believe that people should be able to access these tools in ways that are meaningful to them. And that's also why we do a lot of work around access.
When you talk about not only advertising, but let's stick with advertising for a moment. There are so many tools that the advertising industry uses to basically manipulate us into wanting their product, whatever it is. And a lot of those things are things that have nothing to do with the product itself, but by association, they make you feel like if you drink this particular cheap alcoholic beverage, you will have friends and community and things like that.
Yes, we often start with one of our deconstruction questions we ask is, what are the techniques of persuasion being used in this particular piece of media? So I often ask audiences, when have you ever tried to persuade someone to do something? And many of us have at one time or another tried to persuade someone to help us write a grant, clean their room, drive us somewhere. So those same kinds of techniques that we might use, which include bribery, flattery, maybe even a big lie to get someone to do something, we see those techniques also being employed within media systems, in our news, in advertising. And so those types of techniques can be extremely effective because some, as you're saying, they may not always have anything to do with the product itself. Association is one that's used pretty regularly on almost every ad where they want to associate the product with being successful, with being powerful, with being beautiful. And so we see over and over again these sort of same stories being told through the selling of various products.
And they play into, often, if you look at it, especially in a big picture kind of way, they play into needs that are not being fulfilled in the way that they should be. So people are isolated because of the fact of having to work two jobs for not enough pay, and so they don't have that, for example, leisure time. And then, so it plays on that unmet need, or whatever the unmet need is, to get into your head and make you think that this will somehow solve your problems. But the thing is, if it becomes conscious, then you know it's a lie. But if it plays on your unconscious, then it still is able to remain effective.
Absolutely. And I think that it's not just about playing onto unmet needs, but playing into fears as well. This fear of not being beautiful enough or strong enough or smart enough or wealthy enough, and that if I'm able to get this product, then I will have this quick fix. And that's another technique of persuasion, which we call a simple solution, which is if I just am able to have the right lipstick or drink the right kind of water or be able to hang out with the folks that drink that kind of vodka, then I somehow, all these other systems that are impacting my life are going to shift. And we know that that's not true. And in fact, I know, for example, for me, that's not real. And yet I can still have moments where I might see a particular commercial and think, really? Does that really do that? I'll just have that short moment where they catch me for a moment. And
you think, I want that.
Absolutely. I have those moments. One of the pieces that I often do and that we do as an organization when we're presenting with audiences is we show the reality versus fantasy hamburger. So when we're watching commercials that involve food, particularly on hamburgers, and fast food commercials, we'll see huge hamburgers with perfect shaped buns, and the sesame seeds are placed exactly where they need to be, and they're all like proportionally apart from each other, and the lettuce and tomatoes and everything looks extremely fresh and delicious and juicy. And then if you actually purchase that hamburger and then compare it to what we see in the commercial, it's very different. And so I'll often ask, how many of you have ever eaten at a fast food restaurant? And hands will go up, and I'll say, and is this what the burgers look like? And we'll show the fantasy burger from the ad, and many people say no, not at all, or they'll laugh and say, no, it never looks like that. And I'll say, and well, then here's a reality photo, and we'll show that reality photo, and they'll laugh, and we'll often hear, yes, that's what it looks like. And I'll say, yet how many of us, when that ad is running, think, oh my gosh, that looks really good, and that we want it in that moment, even though we know that it won't look that way, or maybe even taste the way that we think it will. And that has a lot to do also with the power of visual responses and the reptilian brain responding and sort of overriding the neocortex and not letting us pause and think. And sometimes if you take that moment to pause, then you're able to ask those questions or to say to ourselves, wait, it won't look like, I know it won't look like that. I know it won't, it won't taste good. And so we have fun with those kinds of scenarios.
We're talking to Andrea Quijada of the Media Literacy Project. So in a way, what you're doing is getting people to not fully buy into their reptilian brain and to actually think about what they see and let their good thinking guide them and not just go off of the instincts that are being so very consciously manipulated by the people who are making this stuff.
And it's one thing to do that with products, and it's another thing to do, you know, I feel like it's even a more dangerous when it's done with news and information. And when we look at our news and we see how these techniques of persuasion are used, if I'm watching a local news program, yet the images that I'm seeing either aren't local themselves, so I know that somewhere it was outsourced somehow, that this, you know, could have been brought in. It could be what's called a video news release, where a PR firm might be working for Minute Maid, for example. I'm just picking, you know, or let's just say like any orange juice company, and they want to promote their product, and maybe a new report has come out about how delicious and important or how critical it is to have a certain amount of vitamin C. Maybe there's a new report that's come out. So if I'm a PR firm and one of my clients is an orange juice company, then I want to leverage that news, quote-unquote news report about vitamin C in a way that will promote my company. So I will make sure that I have footage of a grocery store where my product is featured. And yet when I send it out with the script, I'll have multiple local news people reading the same script in Atlanta, in Chicago, in Albuquerque, or Santa Fe, and then we'll all be getting the same news story, thinking that it's a local story when it's actually not a local story. And so,
it's not even journalism; it's corporate propaganda.
Yes, yes. And you may remember a few years ago when one of our presidents engaged in that with, and that was, it actually went to Congress because our government had created these video news releases, and we knew that they, you know, our government was then held accountable for that.
What was an example of one of those video news releases?
One of them was with regards to No Child Left Behind. You may remember this was all under Bush, during Bush's first term, and there were a whole series that came out and they hit the news. One helpful documentary, if anyone is interested, is a documentary called Toxic Sludge is Good for You. So I encourage people to check out both. There's a book and a documentary on VNRs in general, if anyone else is interested.
That's a great title.
There was a company that found out that the title of the book was going to be Toxic Sludge is Good for You, who then called the author and said, we want you to change the name of the book because we're not calling it Toxic Sludge anymore. And they had like a different name for Toxic Sludge so that it wouldn't sound like it was toxic.
Oh my goodness.
So it's fun.
So I think one of the things, and this goes for our political system, it goes for the products we use, things that they're trying to sell us. It's not just, I mean, sure, everyone's been persuading somebody to do something since there were human beings with language. That's part of who we are. We try to get each other to do stuff. But the gap between what they seem to be selling and what they're really selling is so vast now. And there's so many just downright lies. I mean, we've done a couple of shows on plastic bags and the plastic water bottle industry and all of that. And that's such a great example of, they're trying to sell you bottled water when you could be drinking tap water and at best putting it through your little Brita filter or whatever. But they're trying to sell you bottled water on the idea that it's healthy and good for you. And when you look at the environmental damage to people, marine life, birds, the environment, and everything else, it's so bad for you. Everything around it is so bad for you. And not only is that left out, but they know it. And they're just trying to somehow sell it anyway and get you to not find out or to be in denial about it because you're buying something which is completely unnecessary, a bottle of water.
There's a really incredible messaging frame right now around being green. And because that frame is so incredibly powerful, we have companies inserting themselves into that frame. So if I'm a bottled water company, I'm going to insert myself into that frame so that I'm green, or that I have the appearance of being green, whether or not I actually fit into that frame. And so we see this kind of messaging happening with Clorox products being green.
Really?
Yes. We've actually done, and again, I encourage folks that we've
done
some deconstructions.
Why? Because it kills E. coli. I mean, what?
We've done some deconstructions on the sort of green movement, and how many things that necessarily weren't green before suddenly green now because that frame is really powerful, or even the sense of somehow getting a hybrid car somehow is going to be greener. Where if we really thought about if everyone got a hybrid car, what would actually be the environmental impact for all the cars that actually already exist currently, as opposed to how do we create ways to shift the cars that exist? Like, what would it mean? It actually feels to me that it would be much greener to just stop making all cars and figure out a way to use the ones that we currently have and keep them running and somehow change them. And so it's really fascinating to see how powerful that the framing and messaging of green is, which I think has been decades of work done by environmentalists and environmental justice movement around really wanting people to understand and think about how do we reuse and recycle, when the reality is low-income communities and many communities around the world have always recycled and reused, sadly, American trash for many, many years, and yet it gets marketed to us in this way that somehow buying green is more important than actually reusing, because consumption is a frame in and of itself also.
Well, and the thing is that the life of these companies, and this is, I think, the fundamental problem, depends on growth, and they're not going to ever have growth if we're reusing and reducing and recycling and all these things that would be really good for our lives and for the environment. I mean, it's a big problem, because, I mean, if everybody did what was green and just stopped buying all this stuff that we don't need and started reusing and recycling and started spending more time with our families and things like that, it would be really bad for the economy.
Right, and that's where we go back to, like, consumption as a frame. And then, of course, we're operating within a whole system of capitalism. And so that absolutely impacts how corporations are going to approach the framework of green versus how an environmentalist would approach that same framework. So for us, too, we really talk about the difference between manipulation and persuasion. And I wanted to comment on what you said, Mary Charlotte, with regards to what companies are trying to get us to do, and is it in our best interests? And so at Media Literacy Project, when we talk about messaging and framing and the work that we do with other nonprofits in messaging and framing, is we talk about manipulation as getting people to do things that are not in their best interest. And persuasion is actually working with communities to move communities forward in ways that will support their interests and needs. And when we're able to separate those out, it becomes much more clear than what kind of messaging and framing we want to play around with and engage in.
We're talking to Andrea Quijada of the Media Literacy Project. So all of this work is done in the framework of what you call at the Media Literacy Project media justice. What does that mean?
So media justice really takes into account the histories and realities of low-income communities, of rural communities, of communities of color. And it's really looking at how do we create new structures and new ways of interacting so that our communities control our own stories. And how do we really shift our communities in from being markets, which leads back to what we were just talking about, that when we're in this consumption framework, when media is solely a business model, then communities are forced to become markets. And we actually know that the real reason media systems existed was to inform us, to give us information, and to really provide paths to community engagement and civic engagement. And when our news is failing to give us the information that we need to participate in our communities in ways that are meaningful or helpful, then what we have and all we're left with is news or programming, any kind of programming, that is serving the interests of the advertisers and not the interests of communities. And again, that is fundamentally in opposition to why and how media systems were created in the first place.
What are some examples of media that are really serving their purpose, helping people to tell the stories of their communities and doing it in a way that it's authentic?
Well, we would. I would love to start with your program right now, Mary Charlotte, to say that, of course.
I would set that up.
I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge your program. And I think that really community-driven media, right now in Albuquerque, we have Quote Unquote, which is a nonprofit entity that's been running our two channels. We have Channel 27, which is our community media channel, and Channel 27, which is Encantada. And they have been doing this excellent job where anyone off of the street can come in, get trained, and create their own program. And so that would definitely be one. We have we've been helped support Prometheus Radio's 10-year battle with the FCC to have low-power FM become feasible and real. And now we know that that's happening. And so at Media Literacy Project, we've been organizing with communities in New Mexico, talking to people about who's interested in having a low power FM station. So we believe in low power FM as a really powerful model for communities to be able to engage and tell stories in that way. And then one of the ways that we also, in terms of creating our own media, we have this annual program, a year-long program that we do called Girl Tech. And in that program, we train young women of color to be filmmakers and tell stories. And then we use the internet as a way also to disseminate that information. And so we also believe in the internet as a way for people to get out information. And that's also why we fight for media policies that ensure an open and free internet, where what we mean by that is that when I get on the computer, I'm going to decide where I'm going, and the internet provider is not going to decide that for me. That if I decide I'm going to go to ksfr.org, I don't get redirected somewhere else, so I don't get slowed down, but I'm sped up if I went to a corporate radio station.
And that's the big fight over so-called net neutrality.
Right, exactly. So we call it internet freedom. The wonky talk, DC talk, is net neutrality. And so we believe in internet freedom and continue to fight for that.
Where is that battle right now?
Well, as you may know, in the fall of 2010, Media Literacy Project co-hosted a huge town hall at the National Hispanic Cultural Center with our partners Free Press and Center for Media Justice. And we had over 400 people come and speak in support of net neutrality. And we had folks from rural areas, Native communities. We had mothers speaking. We had really young students speaking about why they wanted affordable and accessible internet in their homes. Then that fall, in the winter, by December of 2010, the FCC had voted some net neutrality rules. They were a little weaker than what we had hoped. And it also, what they essentially did was created a difference of net neutrality for a mobile device, such as your cell phone, versus if you're wired in. And so we felt that that wasn't okay. We felt that there should be equal net neutrality, that it should be equal opportunity, regardless of what device you're operating on. And then last year, in 2011, we saw Congress come out and really go after the FCC to try and say that what the FCC had ruled shouldn't be allowed. And so we fought against that. And we were able to hold that off. So that's where it's at today. We don't know that there couldn't be some other ways around that, or somebody else wanting to take up that fight against net neutrality. We definitely saw the fight against the Stop Online Piracy Act, both SOPA and the PIPA bills. We saw those as questionable and sort of flew in the face also of net neutrality. And it was interesting to see sort of who supported that versus who had supported net neutrality. And we were really glad to see both SOPA and PIPA die earlier this year. So that's where we're at.
Say more about that, the Stop Online Piracy Act and all of that. First of all, why were you against that? And second, what is the relationship between that and internet freedom?
Well, internet freedom, as I said, essentially means that people have the right to create content, upload it, share it, and do with it what they will. And the Stop Online Piracy Act, while it was really working to stop piracy, it actually went after a much larger group of people. And so we felt it was sort of that kind of situation where if there's a classroom of students and one student acts out and the teacher says no one can go to recess, it was sort of that kind of situation
right.
where there's one person is doing this thing, so everyone's going to have to be punished. And we definitely felt it was too broad, and that we need to find a different way to address the problem.
So you are doing these programs where you're helping people to create their own media. And, you know, it's a world in which we are bombarded with media. People grow up watching Lord knows how many hours of television per day. They're in front of screens. They're on their mobile devices. They're texting. It's almost like...
Yeah, for young people, it's about 10 hours a day with media. That includes radio, television, internet, many of these.
And I saw that, what was it? There was a wonderful documentary recently where all these kids could recognize corporate logos, but they didn't recognize a radish or a leek or even an onion. I mean, just things that are a dandelion, things in nature.
That's interesting. We actually have what we call the media alphabet, where we have different alphabet letters, and we talk about that, and then we'll ask people to identify what's even in their yard. Or we also have t-shirts that say critical thinker, but each letter is also taken from a logo to make people think about how are letters and words formed, particularly when logos become involved.
So. Yeah. So people have so much media in their lives, but then when it comes to creating media, yeah, it's important to have it in the hands of people so that they can tell their own stories, but it's also important to give them or let them develop the craft and the tools and the production values so that it's good, because we've all seen really earnest, kind of pathetic media, if I may be blunt.
Absolutely. And are the programs that we do with the year-long program with Girl Tech, that's actually a way for the young people to come in. They learn multiple skills. So they learn video making, and they learn about media justice. So they learn about some of the policy issues that we've been talking about today, and they understand how and why we use these tools and the context by which we're using these tools. So if net neutrality is something that we have now, we don't. Then we talk about that. We say, this is what net neutrality is. This is what internet freedom is. And we have those conversations around how policy impacts our ability to create stories and disseminate our own stories. And with that particular program, we talk about reproductive justice. And so then the videos are also connected to community and connected to either some sort of policy fight that an organization might be facing. It might be used more as a way to elevate a particular organization. And so the young women then go out and meet and interview different organizations. And so for us, it's also about not creating, and it's fun to watch videos of our dogs or of our cats, and those can be very entertaining. And for us, we feel it's really important that these particular stories that get created are about that involve these young people in their communities and really connect them to ideas and ways of changing communities for the better. And that's how we utilize video making in our particular programs. We teach a 6-week course at the Media Arts Collaborative Charter School. And at the end, the young people are given, you know, their final project is a video project, and it has to relate to some of the campaigns that MLP is working on. So we're part of a Strong Families campaign where we talk about how families look all kinds of ways, and there's lots of ways for families to look and lots of ways for families to be strong. And so they can create a video about that. They can create a video about one of the policy fights that might be happening, or they can create a video on our prison justice campaign, which is where we're looking at how do we ensure that people can remain in communication with incarcerated loved ones and family members in ways that do not cost exorbitant fees, that oftentimes families are burdened with the fees of having to pay to have conversations with incarcerated loved ones. And so this year at the Media Arts Collaborative Charter School, three of the students created one of the final projects was a video against SOPA, and they created this animation piece, and they talked about what the bill was, and we thought it was so well done that we thought our national partners should see it. And so Free Press used it on SaveTheInternet.com, and the Media Action Grassroots Network used it. And so for us, what was really amazing about that was that because we're connected to these national organizations in the work that we do, we were able to elevate this really well-produced piece that young people made about a national policy issue and get it out to thousands of people across the country. And it was really amazing. And I know the young people were so excited that we were able to use their video in that way.
Yeah. We're talking to Andrea Quijada of the Media Literacy Project. You must see such amazing changes in the lives and the minds of the young people who get involved in this work from the moment where they just come in being media kids and then they come out and they you must see a gazillion light bulbs going off in their heads as they begin to understand what they're seeing.
Yes, and sometimes we'll even see it with various staff members. I remember someone who had worked at Media Literacy Project for a few years, and she was someone who really loved the wrestling shows. And one time at our Catalyst training, we played one of a documentary by Media Education Foundation, which really deconstructed how gender was really sort of created and enforced within that system and within those shows. And I remember she just had this whole emotional response to really rethinking about this program that she'd watched for years and had really loved it, and really was struggling with realizing that maybe it wasn't the most helpful program for her to watch. And so we've even had that happen with people that have joined the team. And we see that absolutely happen with both adults and young people when we're presenting, with people having those moments. And sometimes we'll even hear it later, particularly sometimes with young people, where it'll be a few years later that they'll say, that class, maybe I seemed really bored in it, but I never stopped thinking about that class for the rest of the time I was in high school. Or so we often get those stories too, so maybe we don't always get to see every aha in that moment, but we absolutely have people come back to us years later telling us the impact that our programs and trainings have had on their lives.
What about you? I mean, was there some moment where when you were a young woman, you or a girl in school or whatever, you saw something and you realized you were being manipulated or you started to look at things in a new way?
I would say for me, I grew up in a home without a television, and so I didn't interact with media as much as many of my classmates.
What good parents you have.
Young people. And yes, we read lots of books. And so I would say I was really impacted and had really strong relationships to music and also to magazines. And so I remember in high school I started to get various magazines such as 17 or like teen magazines. And I remember in college there was a particular instance after I had gotten a subscription to more of a high fashion magazine. I won't name which one it was. And I remember because I really loved fashion. I know how to sew. That's something I grew up doing. And so I love fabrics and clothing. And so I was flipping through it. And then I remember, I don't know, after I put the magazine down, I went by and passed a mirror. And I remember hearing what I was saying about myself as I passed that mirror, like really degrading comments that came up in my head. And in that moment, I realized, oh, that happens after every time I read those magazines.
Ah.
So I canceled my subscription that day. And I just
I
remember thinking, those thoughts are in my head. So how do I stop this from happening? And for me, that was one easy thing that I could do. That doesn't mean that I still don't have moments with certain images today or certain, as we talked about earlier, certain products where I think, wow, does that product really clean the counter like that? Or whatever it might be that I'm thinking in that moment. But it's great. And I think that at Media Literacy Project, we're able to have those conversations with each other and to be able to laugh at ourselves and laugh with each other in our process of sort of undoing what we've been taught and how we've been taught to think, and really how do we engage in thinking critically.
There is this thing that, and I know it's a product of its time, I think it's a little bit different right now, but I think when I was growing up, when I was probably a teenager, it was almost like you had to make a choice between femininity and intellectualism. You know, you couldn't really be a in-your-power feminine woman. You had to sort of de-gender yourself a little bit in order to be intellectually powerful. And I think that's changed a lot. But you don't think it's changed a lot? She's making little eye gestures.
I don't think it has changed that much. I think that there's some very... Sadly, the ideas of gender are so ingrained that what we have seen is that while women in the real world, right, where we're sitting right now in the real world, while we have seen some of those changes happen, I think that on screen, the ideas of what women should be or how they can be have become more limited.
Oh, I'm not talking about on screen. I'm talking about in real life. I mean, it seems to me, from the not very many, but some young women who I know who are really in their power haven't sacrificed their femininity.
I think that can be true. And I think that for me, this leads into the conversation around understanding that I think gender is much more than binary and that I believe that women should be able to, and men and people who maybe don't identify as either necessarily male or female or man or woman in those limited terms, I think that anyone should be able to express their gender and their identity in any way. And so while it may be true that we have some areas of change that have happened, we still see very real rules around these binaries that have come into place. And so thinking, how do we continue to challenge that? How do we create space for gender to be much more fluid? And how do we really support our transgender brothers and sisters in those conversations?
Andrea, so here we are talking about the Media Literacy Project, and I guess it's sort of my orientation that I am so interested in how young people are reacting in the schools, because I didn't get any of that stuff when I was in school, and it would have been very useful for me as a child and as a teenager to be able to deconstruct what was around me, because it was very confusing, and then you do that stuff later. Okay, but what kind of projects are you doing outside of the schools for adults, for other people in the community?
Well, we do many things. We are part of the Latinos for Internet Freedom campaign, so that continues the conversation we're talking about with regards to net neutrality and other policy battles. And so we really work to ensure that Latino voices and Latino communities are really integrated into the policy conversations. We are also part of Black Voices for Internet Freedom, and we are currently developing an advisory team of folks throughout New Mexico to really help support us as we launch that this year. And we're also the anchor organization for the Media Action Grassroots Network, also known as MAGNET. And MAGNET has about 10 anchors across the country. We have nearly 200 organizations, and each anchor is tasked with building up your region. And so we really work to talk about media justice and media policy issues on the local level, integrating sort of cross-sector conversations. So what I mean by that is, while we are a media literacy project, we are working and talking to youth media organizations. We are talking to reproductive justice organizations. We talk to environmental justice groups, as well as immigration and immigrant rights groups. And so we have these really broad depth of conversations around how does various media policy impact each of these communities in very real and unique ways. And so that we're able to really understand how we engage communities in these media policy battles, particularly when they're happening primarily in D.C., if they're federal policy. And it's very easy to think that it's something that's happening far away from us. But the reality is, if any of you, you know, if any of us have cell phones, if we use laptops, if we watch television, then we actually care about media policy, because we're using these tools every day that policy, you know, the reason we have those tools is there are policies in place that allow us to use these tools in specific ways and also limit how we use those tools in specific ways. So there's reasons why if you have a certain phone, you might not be able to use it with a particular carrier. So what I mean by that is, if I have an iPhone, I can't use it on T-Mobile. Well, that's because there's policies in place that allow or disallow corporations and companies to play with each other in particular ways. And so knowing those policies become really important. So we're really excited that we're part of a toolkit, a cell phone toolkit that's going to be launched this year called Dialed In. And we wrote the media literacy piece of it. And we're working with the Center for Urban Pedagogy out of New York City, People's Production House out of New York City, and Voces Móviles, or Mobile Voices, out of LA, and the Media Literacy Project. So each of us wrote a part of this it's sort of like a four-chapter curriculum on cell phones and how policies and advertising and marketing of cell phones impact each of us every day.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because, I mean, okay, I've got an iPhone, I can't use it on T-Mobile, so what?
Well, what that can mean is that's what's called a handset exclusivity law. And in terms of as consumers, when you think about us as having rights, the reality is that would be similar to saying, oh, you just bought this car, but you can only gas up at Chevron, but you can't gas up at any other station.
But there are things, I mean, okay, to whatever extent that's important, I think there are, I mean, you were talking for a moment ago about things that, for me, are a lot more down to earth, like reproductive rights, immigrant rights, and things like that. And making the connection between that and media policy, I think, would be interesting.
Well, one of the things that we talk about is, in particular, is that if we aren't able to share the information that is ours to share, if I want information, for example, on reproductive health, and I go try to get online to access that information, but we don't have net neutrality, and anytime I type in the words reproductive health, I'm blocked from particular websites, or my line is slowed down because my internet carrier doesn't believe that I should be able to access that information, then that poses a problem.
Right.
And so that's actually a real threat to how we receive and share information about any of these topics. If I'm an immigrant and I need to be able to update my immigration status, and the only way that I can do that is online, and you may be familiar with the fact that many government programs now are solely online. So if people want to access housing information, if they want to access food stamps, if they want to access any of these programs, it is often online. And so what's happened is that the burden has been placed often on our libraries, where people are lining up to have access to the internet so that they can sign up for these government programs, and yet we're not seeing the government then provide the resources for people to be able to have their own access to the internet. So this is impacting all kinds of communities in various and real ways that impact their day-to-day lives. And it's also shifting in so many ways, like how people organize. And so if we're able to use media as an organizing tool, we can actually get our message out faster to many more people than we could before. And if we're blocked, then that poses a problem. To come
and
back
now,
to reproductive rights,
okay.
NARAL, which is an
National Abortion Rights Action League.
Yes. So they are a national organization that is in support of abortion. When they tried to send out a text a couple of years ago, their phone carrier that they were using, Verizon, blocked that text and would not let them send it.
Oh, my goodness.
So when we talk about why does media policy matter to reproductive rights, that would be one clear example. But it matters regardless of who you are or what sector you're working in. It matters. If you're on the other side of the debate and you couldn't get your message out, that wouldn't be okay either. So it's really about how do we ensure that these tools are protected by and for consumers. And we were thrilled as the Media Literacy Project to have been asked to join the Consumer Advisory Committee to the FCC. So we're currently serving a 2-year appointment. So we get to have these conversations within our working groups and make recommendations to the FCC. We're currently working on, as I mentioned earlier, reducing the cost of phone calls that families pay when they're trying to call their loved ones who are in prison. And so we're looking at communication rights and prison justice as being also an area of intersection. So the reality is media policies impact each of us all the time.
In ways that we really don't even know about half the time. I mean,
well, and due to media consolidation too, it's very difficult with if some companies, for example, NBC and Comcast are merging, such as they did last year. I'm not trusting NBC News to report accurately on what's happening with the merger or what the implications of that merger are going to be when they control the information. So,
right.
So again, it just gets more and more muddy in the water as we start looking at how media policy and media consolidation impact the all the information that we receive every day.
I think the bottom line here, and we just, it seems like no matter what we talk about, we keep on coming back to this problem, is corporate ownership of the infrastructure of our daily lives and ultimately corporate ownership of our government are the reality within which we live, and it's totally antithetical to democracy.
Absolutely.
And that comes out all the time.
Absolutely. And when you look, and I mentioned it before, but when you look at the history of media creation and the structures themselves and who they were initially set up to serve and who they serve now, it's the complete opposite. They're serving the corporations and not serving the people.
So how can people get involved in Media Literacy Project if they want to?
There are so many ways. We encourage people to check out our website at medialiteracyproject.org. We are also always seeking volunteers, and we have volunteers that help us with our advocacy work. We have volunteers that support our administrative work or some of our program work. And so it's as simple as calling our main line at 505-828-3129. And please check us out also on social networking. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And that's, you know, follow us on Twitter. Keep up to date that way. It's really easy to engage with us on Facebook and leave comments and post information. And that's really how a really quick and easy way for us to engage. And we are super excited to kick off our Sustainer program this year. Our next year will be our 20th anniversary. So we are getting ready for that. And we have been given the opportunity to match a $20,000 grant this year. And we are encouraging anyone who believes in democracy, who believes that media should serve democracy and serve our people, to become a sustainer to Media Literacy Project. Even $5 a month, $10 a month, if you can give $20 a month, that would be great. But you go to our website, click on our donate page, you'll see the thermometer that we have that tells us like how much we're raising this year, and we're really, really excited to kick off the Sustainer program. So if anyone is interested or you believe in critical thinking, please become a sustainer to Media Literacy Project so that we can continue to grow our work for New Mexico.
Andrea Quijada is the director of the Media Literacy Project. Once again, medialiteracyproject.org. Anything else before we go?
Again, we just want to say that it's through the creation of systems and making sure that policies are community-led, community-driven, that ensure that we can all access, analyze, and create meaningful media and make it relevant to our daily lives. And we just want to really encourage people to join Media Literacy Project.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.